dense development in some of our single family neighborhoods. And when you look at the yellow on the map, that's all single family. So you can see most of our land supply is dedicated to that particular use. And what these architects and developers and planners are saying, can't we get more around some places that are in those neighborhoods that are really well suited for supporting more households? And, you know, a good model of that are some of our older neighborhoods from that area in the 50s where we mixed it up more. You have parks and streets and transit. Those are good places for more households. But we are a single-family house city, at least in these yellow areas, and we sort of have a covenant with the public on this. And a comp plan that we're planning now is the comp plan for the future made by the people and households of today. So our sort of overall willingness to pick places where we're going to start to seek those kind of changes may be a little constrained by that. And the fact that we can identify these centers and corridors as being able to at least accept the growth that we see, actually benefit from the growth that we see over the next 20 years, that's why that was our focus, not to go where Rick was encouraging us to go. Although any given neighborhood where it's single family blocks around a house that wants to come in and embrace this idea that let's go to townhouses or mid-rise, we of course would be open to talking about that and look at it holistically. But what we really need to figure out is in the 80s, part of how we cut the agreement or the way the plan turned out was a lot of our corridors and streets are zoned mixed use, but it only goes 100 feet deep. And then the back, and our blocks are 200 feet, so the back half of that block is often single-family residential. And, you know, I don't know exactly, but I can imagine why we did that, but I imagine that's what people could accept at that time. What's different now is that we're actually seeing the stuff that plan called for get built, and I think what we know is doing a mixed-use building that integrates into a single-family neighborhood over 200 feet is a whole lot more likely to succeed than over 100. So are there places in our centers where we could start to move in that direction as well? In our thinking, where we've been able to identify some, we've sort of tried to move forward on that. I think that our completion of the comp plan is going to be followed by these center development strategies where we can actually try to cut some of those deals, because I think the overall quality of development can be improved and some of the other neighborhood objectives could be met. But you have to look at it more closely to the place. It's not a broad brush, let's reset the policy move.
So when you said our covenant with the public, is that what you're meaning, that we would not intrude in the single-family residential zones?
Well, I think in the past, a little bit, our expectations, Commissioner, just remember when we had the apartments without parking discussion, and actually you all heard it this morning when you talked about neighborhood parking permits. That's a little bit renegotiating what some people thought they were buying into when they bought the house. Like, that's my parking space, it's going to stay my parking space. And for the benefit of the overall system, we want to manage it differently now. And also, to meet the objectives that we set for ourselves in the 80s, it's turned out to be parking, and neighborhood parking's turned out to be a system we need to manage, and we're going to get the most out of it that way. But remember when we did parking for apartments, people were shocked that we were allowing buildings that weren't totally covering their parking because they were going to park on residential streets, even though the percentage of occupancy, like Judith was talking about this morning, wasn't that great. We made a move to reduce the pressure because backlash, holding up development is part of what I'm talking about. We need to build a system that has backlash built into it that's going to slow down that growth. It's going to hurt the overall affordability of the city. We want it to be developed well in the right places, and sometimes these adjustments are necessary just sort of in terms of social change and politically to keep moving forward.
Just to continue with the parking discussion, I think that people who live within a block of Division in the 30s might say, well, instead of having a group of apartments right on Division, why don't you have more duplexes a few blocks away? Because my dad happens to live four blocks from Division, and I never have a hard time parking near his house, but three blocks away you do. So would there, I think that there might would be some people, at least, who would argue that you'd have less housing right on the main street and more semi-multifamily housing a few blocks away, but maybe that messes with the, with other objections with the centers and corridor strategy, which is to have everybody right next to transit or something?
No, I think it's more, we'll move on to that sort of debate next. We need to solidify our ability to deliver the progress in centers and corridors, because then we can meet our 25-year objectives and do it in a way that, regardless of what we do with the single family, is the right thing to do, we believe. We welcome those kind of discussions about different product types being added to single family neighborhoods in the way that the single family neighborhood, in the way that works. And it's a little bit what Commissioner Fritz was saying and what we're trying to do in the infill progress project, look for these kind of new, not really new, but these housing types and get them introduced in more parts of the city. Because you can see around the world and elsewhere in the city, they work perfectly well in a single family setting.
Well, and some of us remember the ADU discussion when it was the end of the world as we know it, that when we discussed having ADUs, and lo and behold, everybody actually quite likes them, and now they're a way to make your housing more affordable. Do we know how many new internal ADUs are being built, so properties that are being built with a non-detached ADU?
We could track that down. I don't have that off the top of my head.
I think that might be an alternative to highlight that, where you don't necessarily want to waste the space in your backyard, or you might want to continue to have a backyard, that if we could persuade some developers to do internal ADUs, that would be a way to increase housing affordability.
And one of the ideas that's on the table in the infill project is, what if you allowed two ADUs, one inside, one detached, because you could, fix up the basement, fix up the attic. So that's in discussion. But in the interest of staying on time, I'd like to move to the next part of the work session, if we're ready. So I'm going to kick it off and then turn it over to Kurt. This half of the work session, we want to talk about the policies in the comprehensive plan related to affordability, anti-displacement. And by affordability here, we're talking about provision of housings and ideally permanently affordable housing for low-income households. So that this is the second part of that overall comp plan housing strategy. And remember, it's to increase the supply of permanently affordable housing. That's the big umbrella. And in there, you will find comp plan policies that call for us to produce as much regulated affordable housing as we can figure out how to produce. The need or the number of those households will always exceed our ability to produce those kind of units. Secondly, part of that, and this is not a land use thing, but it's a implementation suggestion, is this notion that as federal funds fluctuate, we need to treat affordable housing as infrastructure and identify local fundings, reliable local funding mechanisms to help meet these housing goals. We need to increase the affordable housing tools, as the planners say, which are just the different ways that we get at incenting or supporting the production of affordable housing. At that forum at PSU on Friday, the keynote also made the observation is that there's no big solution to this issue, and that the best tactics that he's seen are a collection of these, 2% solutions is what he called them. You just stack them up and you keep moving forward in that way. A little bit, that's what this increase the housing, the affordable housing tools is about. Can we get authorized to use inclusionary housing even if we don't choose to do it? Get the tools lined up. And increase housing stability through increased rental protections, and you all just talked about that this week as well. It's not a strictly comprehensive plan type of policy, but it's part of this overall housing affordability program or topic. And the last one was to continue to enforce fair housing requirements. That's the comp plan bundle in terms of policy direction. So one of the key pieces of what's in those housing policies is that the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended a housing target by 2035, an affordable housing target. And that target would produce at least 10,000 new regulated units, new program permanently affordable units citywide, that would be affordable to households earning less than 80% median family income. So that's the target that they set in the comprehensive plan. And Kurt's going to talk about what it's going to take to potentially implement something like that. But let me explain where that target came from. The Planning and Sustainability Commission today, about 10% of the total housing stock is in regulated units. And so, and in the Portland plan, we set a goal for ourselves of 15% of the housing stock to be that as we grow. And in the comprehensive plan, and that 15% in the Portland plan was market rate and program or regulated units. So the Planning and Sustainability Commission wanted to try to set a number ambitious, it's ambitious, but that keeps the proportion of regulated units in our housing supply the same as it is today. At a minimum, we don't want to go backwards in that particular regard. And the way we did the math, it came up to be about 10,000 units by 2035.
That's keeping it at 10% of the regulated supply? Mm-hmm. Or?
Yeah, close. And actually, if we...
Where'd the figure 30% come from? I thought...
30% is downtown.
Downtown.
Oh. Yeah, central city.
In the central city, today, actually, in the central city, 30% of the housing supply is regulated units, something like that. And so, once again, we're just saying don't go backwards. And they're both really difficult sort of objectives to try to meet. And in the spirit of that, I want to turn it over to Kirk to talk about the Housing Bureau's analysis of what the implications of this particular goal are.
Thank you, Joe. First, I'd like to recognize Planning and Sustainability as great partners to the Housing Bureau. I've worked in a lot of jurisdictions, and oftentimes the planners aren't working that closely with the implementors, but I was delighted on my second week on the job to have read all the comp plan materials. Joe, Susan, Tom, Eric are doing fine work, and although our boards don't meet together much, they probably should be, and we could probably learn a lot from each other. Just a couple of baselines. I'm director of the Housing Bureau, and I'm reminded that we have some baseline markers. In other words, in the context of preparing the 2035 comprehensive plan, we have present day need. In other words, this is not a reset of our current need. It is basically in addition to our present day need. We know today that we are about 24,000 units short of what we think we need to provide a reasonable choice in our marketplace. The additional 10,000 would take us up to about 35,000 total units. I don't see that as terribly daunting. I do think it means that we have to change the way that we deliver housing, and we have to change the scale at which we operate to be able to make good progress on that. And when I first read the plan, I thought, okay, 8% of the total, we can do that. We can do better. But then I read the State of Housing report, and retrospectively, we hadn't done some previous goals and targets. So I'm content with the 10,000 number goal, partly because I think we can beat it. As an advocate, I'd like to exceed that, but I'm reluctant to put that into policy because it's not capitalized. And one thing that I think observe, which I think I mentioned when we did the State of Housing report last week, is that when we established the no net loss policy, or when the city council established the no net loss policy for housing downtown, it was never capitalized. There was never a regulatory regime nor a capital asset strategy put into place to make sure that that goal was achieved. And lo and behold, the privately owned affordable housing that was not regulated has largely lost conversions to market rate. So I didn't want to fall into that habit of doing business, so we wanted to try to quantify for you to the greatest extent possible what it would take to deliver 10,000 affordable units. Inside the back folder of your packet is a memo or a one-page summary from me. And just to hit the high points, we basically did a 20-year estimate of the available revenue, knowing what we know today. And that is what affordable housing cost in 2015 dollars, what we're able to leverage with public funds from private sector in 2015. So we assume the same cost per unit going forward and the same leverage ratio of 3-1 going forward. We currently know under current policy that tax increment financing would total some $192 million. That's at the current 30% level. We're not projecting your decision, which you can discuss next week when we gather again. We are projecting some declines in federal funding of about 3%. The home program would then impute to about $37 million in resources. $21 million. The CDBG program would produce about $37 million. We've committed resources to existing projects of some $88 million, and we have created reserves for the preservation of existing units. So we have about $112 million that we can reliably predict as revenue available in the next 20 years. We compare that against our current pipeline of 1,100 units, which is the second half of the bottom of the page, and can impute our pipeline based on available revenue. We also added into this estimate the units that we think could reliably be produced through the Central City Density Update, which you've heard but not necessarily enacted just yet. And we've looked at the units available through the multi-limited use tax exemption program. So we think in 2035, some 17,620 units could be produced. So we're short about 5,380 units. And we impute a value of those of about $538 million, or $27 million a year. I do this just as a meta-analysis, but recognizing that we're talking about a series of 2% solutions. The ADUs, for example, in the plan as drafted, there's some 3,000 ADUs that are projected over the next 20 years. Were you to attach either a property tax exemption or an SDC exemption with the caveat that the unit be affordable, some of those could be affordable for a specific period of time. Currently, state law doesn't allow a property tax exemption for an ADU because both sides of the house have to be owner-occupied. We'll be talking with legislators about that, and we think that's perhaps a surgical amendment that could be had in Salem. And I'm mindful that you've already discussed sunsetting the current SDC waiver next year. However, were it to be considered to be extended for a limited affordability, I think you might actually be able to produce additional affordable units. We are planning and have proposed in the fall budget modification process the funding necessary to prepare a Nexus study. The Nexus study would look at the commercial linkage fee issue and how a commercial linkage fee would properly be structured in Portland. And just as a thumbnail sketch, housing doesn't create housing demand, employment creates housing demand. And you look at different segments of employment to impute housing demand based on the wage profile of the employees. So if you're building a hotel, your hotel service workers are earning an income of perhaps minimum wage, perhaps slightly higher, and you can impute housing demand for that workforce based on the use. You do the same thing for office, you do the same thing for manufacturing. And from that, you then can derive a fee. That fee then has to be market tested to make sure that you're not turning the economics of particular deals upside down and essentially killing the economic viability of a certain sector. And with that knowledge, you can then reliably project what an appropriate fee should be. We think they can work in concert with bonus density incentives. And having come from Fairfax, Virginia, for who the last 25 years has been producing affordable housing units through their inclusionary zoning program, I do think that there's room for both. From what I understand, the inclusion would be most successful in the transit corridors, really outside of the current purview in the central city density. And that's because those transit corridors already have sufficient density. You're not likely to reward them with more density because they're currently at a market maximum likely to attract any developer. But were you to require a portion of affordability and a state law supported that action, you could see significant production. Fairfax's baseline was any project over 50 units had to provide 12% affordability. And if you were in a transit-rich location, such as the Metro Silver Line between Dulles Airport and the District of Columbia, the minimum was 20%. So, pardon? Well, I just want to make sure that you know that private developers have no problem doing business in Northern Virginia. And they are, in that instance, receiving offsetting density and find it a lucrative business model for them. And it's not rocket science, I guess is what I'm putting down for you, is we know how to do this. It's really a matter of having the correct sort of political enabling legislation in force. And then there are some other plays that I think are worth mentioning. We've talked about Airbnb. I do think you can bond against the Airbnb revenue. Be happy to work with your management and budget office and your chief financial officer on that. But it would be possible to raise $10 million in the next 6 months with the current revenue stream that you have. Your demolition tax is obviously an effort to forestall or reduce the amount of demolition, so it wouldn't be wise to pick a number on the demolition tax and securitize that, because hopefully you'll actually be seeing fewer of them. But of those that do go forward, you'll be able to capture that value. I think the other thing that I would mention is the housing cost burden. This came up at yesterday's hearing, and it's something that I don't think can be ignored, and that is that today, even though we're short some 24,000 housing units, of the households that have incomes under 80% of median income, 55% are cost burden. 55% pay more than 30% of their income on rent and utilities. So we have a baseline affordability problem. Matthew Scheibel would have to impute that for you. I think Matthew, I'd rely on Matthew.
Under 50?
It's under 80.
Under 80.
Yeah. He'll pass us a note, I think. He's in the audience. Yeah. Right. So my point is that you could add these units and not affect that number. So people are cost burdened, and that desperation that you saw at yesterday's hearing is starting to become very palpable amongst even moderate income folks. And so I think the 10,000 unit number is something that's eminently attainable. We wanted to put down at least an estimate of what that would cost, some $27 million a year over 20 years. And we'll have a chance next week to talk about the first of those 2% solutions, which is the TIF allocation for housing beyond the 30% minimum.
I have a question, and first of all, thank you for doing this one pager. This has long been missing in our debate, sort of putting the marker down out into the future and then quantifying what it would cost to get there. It's pretty stark. You have about two-thirds of the way down in italics, the phrase, the clause, less preservation of existing units in portfolio. And I'm going to ask you if you could just explain that a little more, because the first thing that came to my mind is we're talking about adding units, but we're assuming a static inventory. And what we know from recent history is expiring use contracts, senior housing built with labor, pension fund money, and other things. We have a lot of at-risk housing. So how do you balance projecting going forward what the need is against the ongoing risk of erosion of the existing inventory?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I was asked by Martha Pellegrino to meet with the one of the state legislators from Eastern Oregon who is leading the Republican caucus in developing a housing strategy for that caucus. It's tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. And mindful that this is a short session upcoming, we've put a few tax measures on our list. And one is the renewal of existing multi-property tax exemption properties. Some of you know the Sitka, the Ramona, both Turtle Bay properties. They are privately owned, privately developed properties that received a 10-year exemption. And the current construct doesn't allow that to be extended. And we'd like to find a way to extend those exemptions into the future.
In other words, have the right locally to work with the county chair and the assessor to determine whether we want to bear those collectively those costs.
Correct. Correct.
I mean, have that discussion.
If you're extending affordability, I think the public policy nexus is a strong one and a discussion that needs to happen. If they already have affordable covenants on the property through a tax credit partnership or some other financing stipulation, then it may not be necessary. But I do think having that flexibility would be a good thing.
So if we could just take a few more minutes, and then we've got a discussion period at the end. We got one more piece, and Eric's going to talk about the anti-displacement policies that are in the comp plan, and then we have till 4 o'clock to talk.
Thank you. So shifting gears from the target policy to a couple of the other policies in the plan, in the housing chapter, but also some of these are in other chapters as well. And the Planning Commission had a pretty robust discussion of, as was discussed earlier, what is the toolbox? And so a number of the policies in the housing chapter and in other chapters are designed to leave a path or provide hints to what kind of an expansion of those toolboxes could we look at. And so it's not any one individual policy, whether that tool will work out, but in general, there's a whole suite of policies about giving us a broader perspective on searching for tools, whether it's land banking or inclusionary zoning or other things like that. So that's one theme in the housing chapter is that tool survey. The second theme is what I would describe as borrowing from maybe the environmental policy construct, which is to look at when you're looking at planning decisions to think about what the impacts are, in this case on housing and affordability, to do analysis at that level and then to mitigate where you know there's going to be an impact. An unavoidable impact. And so, again, borrowing from the environmental construct, in many of our planning decisions, we're used to doing some kind of impact analysis with a planning decision or with a major development decision or a major piece of infrastructure. What we're saying with many of these policies is do that kind of upfront analysis of what your likely impact is going to be with planning decisions, and thus the why this is in the comp plan. So it, as was discussed earlier, an example of that is we know we're going into transit projects in the future if we move forward with the Southwest Corridor. What these policies say is to do that analysis of the likely impact on housing supply and affordability with projects like that, with major planning activities and investments, and where you find an impact, try to quantify that impact, and then move forward with some kind of mitigating activity, and that should be, as a going forward, a policy of the cities. So those two things, the expansion of the toolbox and the analysis and mitigation component are new to the comp plan. The other policy I want to mention before opening up is, and you kind of hit on it in a variety of your discussions earlier, but this idea that there are high opportunity areas on this map. Those places that are near transit, near employment, have close by services and amenities where the resident of that area is set up to succeed. And so we are also asserting as a policy in here that there is, within the boundaries of fair housing and within the boundaries of not putting all the affordable housing in one place, that there is an approach to putting affordable housing in high opportunity areas that we ought to be looking at. It's not just seeking the cheapest land far from transit.
And just remember, in the comp plan as a whole, there's steering growth towards these kind of areas and moving areas that lack some of those characteristics to be more complete neighborhoods, to become these high opportunity areas. We're not trying not to leave other parts of the city behind. With that, we have a period of discussion here. So.
The packet of policies that the Planning Commission specifically added in response to testimony on anti-displacement.
Well, let me raise an issue that don't mind the pun, it's a little bit at the margins of this, and that is what's happening around the edge of the city limits with respect to, if you look at this anti-displacement set of policies, there's one about urban form. There's one about equity of distribution of housing, which we just talked about. How confident are you as our planners or you as our commissioners that we've gotten it right with respect to the interfaces with Gresham, Wood Village, Milwaukee, Lake Oswego, Beaverton, in terms of what the urban form is going to be, you know, what's 162nd going to be like as a street in a more urbanized version of Portland and Gresham, now that Milwaukee's plugged into the Orange Line. They have some pretty ambitious plans for redevelopment. How well does that interface with what we think is going to happen to Garthwick and the southern edge of Selwood? How confident are we that we're planning complete communities where we have the inconvenience of a city limit line running through the middle of the planning area? And how well does that fit in with our anti-displacement efforts? That isn't just, we don't want to displace you, period, but if people are moving within the city and within the region, are we creating authentic communities as close as possible to the core of the city, some of which may be not in Portland? I mean, it's a subject we haven't talked much about, and I just wanted to raise it. We don't have to cover it today necessarily, but it's specifically mentioned here in terms of urban form development. So how equitable is it beyond our city limits, going back to the issue that Commissioner Fish mentioned earlier?
I think that's a really important issue and sort of an issue of our time right now. We've gone through it. In the time I've been in Portland, we cycle in and out of this kind of reaching across the borders and doing coordination or collaboration like that. We have a pretty good working relationship with Gresham and the Planning Bureau right now. Like you said, they have ambitious plans in Milwaukee, but there's a lot of room there to try to kick it up. The transit project on Powell and Division connects Central City with Mount Hood College and Gresham. So that's one where, at least with the excuse of a project, we have the ability to collaborate. But it's not very well developed, Commissioner, right?
I would say from a Southwest Portland, Joe has been focused on the East one, and I've been working more on the Southwest. And I think the same is true there, that the project gives us a construct to have that collaboration at a much deeper level than just the usual sitting at the same room with Metro.
I think it's one for more work, not just a quick discussion today. And it may fall to a couple of us who are serving on regional committees to wade back into that. I mean, I had all kinds of fun with Beaverton trying to work out a rational city limit line along our western edge. If you thought citing the Southwest Community Center was fun, imagine telling people that in Beaverton that they really should be in Portland or vice versa. Once burned, twice shy. I shouldn't even raise the subject. But I think beyond the corridors of Division Powell and Barber, I think there are a lot of places where we don't have complete communities along the edge. We might be able to pull that off in coordination with our neighbors, but I bet we won't get there by accident.
Well, something that Mike Abatze and I have discussed regarding parks, you know, maybe Gresham has more land, and what if they were able to develop a community center close to the border, and then we could perhaps run it or something non-traditional like that. I think there's certainly some opportunities for collaboration, particularly on the east where the line just is zigzagging all over, and BOAC operators have to look it up constantly. They know, of course, but...
To your question about credibility, how comfortable we are, I put a lot of emphasis on the efficiency and the credibility of this anti-displacement coalition. They are a very qualified, capable group, and they speak not so much about borders as about fairness. So I really believe that the confidence you're asking for, that we're asking you to give, has a lot to do with the partner we had in putting all this together. I, as a commissioner, others can join in, were overly impressed with this group. It came together in a very meaningful way and created something we needed as a framework in building this plan.
Joe and Kurt, first of all, just a superb presentation and timely, to say the least. Just three comments or questions. The first is, Kurt, I'd like to have a better sense of how you define at-risk properties generally. That includes buildings where subsidies may end
and we lose the affordability, include expiring use contracts. It would include senior facilities that are financed through other means. Just what's the universe of the at-risk? Because I think we have to always keep an eye on what we're losing and also what we're gaining. And I know NOAA is doing a lot of great work around that. Number two, Joe, I love policy 3.9 in the document that Howard just referred to about growth and development and evaluating potential impacts. I fear that we have honored that more in the breach than the observance in the biggest capital spending plan that we've seen in our community over the last 10 years, which is the Orange Line. So let me just put it to you directly. What housing strategies did we incorporate into the biggest single bet we've made in transportation in a decade?
Within the city's section of the Orange Line, I know that what we looked at was the housing development potential at each of the station areas. That's sort of, you know, at a minimum, the target where we want to be able to make sure that we have development capacity that could accommodate greater density housing, employment, so that they support each other. I don't know what we did in the planning of that project vis-a-vis affordable housing. And part of the dilemma that we always face because of our practice of housing in the 80s is that we upzoned. Our philosophy then was we weren't really confident we were going to see that kind of production, and we really wanted to get out of the way and make it happen. So we gave away some things that now you might want to use as a bonus, like Kurt is saying, to be able to incent it. And then after that, you face the predicament that Kurt just described too about our resources and where they go and having priority for the housing resources in opportunity areas and other things like that. But beyond that, I'm not really sure what the affordable housing play was on the Orange Line.
And I think the reason it's useful to put that on the table now is that we do have some other big planning exercises in the future, including Barber Boulevard and high-speed transit up east side routes and elsewhere. And I understand the limitations of our toolkit. But as we make public investments, I hope that when they come to the council, particularly around transportation, we're very intentional about how we're going to leverage housing affordable to people priced out of the market at each one of these places where we make a huge public investment. And I read 3.9 in the document Howard referred to, it seems like that's precisely what the spirit of that is. You're putting a big bed of public resources in. It's going to have an impact. It's going to actually lead to displacement in the immediate areas because of the speculation, the kind of development, and figure out what tools we have to insist that we're embedding affordable housing options in each of those major stops at a minimum. Because I'm not aware in the Orange Line and I was on the council during most of that time, so I'm not criticizing anyone. I'm criticizing myself. I'm not aware we had any clear sense of how to capitalize on that public investment in terms of affordable housing.
So just in what I feel I need to make one comment about the housing impact assessment. Technically, like if you talking to Eco Northwest or the folks we'd be asking to do this, it's not a simple sort of thing to tease out how each of these projects could be associated with housing price increases or displacement, because just the economics of it are a little not, you know, there's a lot of factors. And for instance, when Eco Northwest took a quick look at the Powell Division line, what they discovered is that because, at least in the city of Portland, we had upzoned that land so long ago, so high, that when you start to break it out into what the causes of price increases are likely to be, it was more related to all this background price increase that we've been talking about all during the work session, supply and demand, than they thought they could attribute to the BRT. But of projects of a certain scale, we absolutely need to be doing this assessment. It's not simple.
No, and in fairness, what I'm really getting at is, at a very time where the federal government is looking at cost around the combined cost of your rent and your transportation costs, and we're trying to make sure that we locate affordable housing options next to transit so we don't double burden people, I just want to make sure that these enormous investments we make, matching federal dollars, leverage some affordable housing in these developments. And we've got a bunch in the pipeline coming to us over the next 10 years. Not another Orange Line, but other kinds of big transportation investments.
I would just point out, part of this is not only connected to 3.9, but it is the gentrification and the involuntary displacement. So as you make those investments, the real idea is that you don't say, we're going to build 2,000 affordable housing units, but we involuntarily displace 5,000 because we made it more attractive. I mean, we will make Powell Division more attractive for people to move into the marketplace. And that's the key. We want to activate those corridors, whether it's Powell, Sandy, Barber Boulevard, and they're more attractive because the cost of living there is cheaper because you have the transit, and you get that complete neighborhood completeness. That is a marketplace that then attracts high. We've seen that in Portland, and we've used that advantage to create better neighborhoods, transit. But if we displace the people around there and we displace the businesses also, we can't forget about the businesses, we net-net better off through the investment, the infrastructure investment. So I think, to your point, you need to think about how you make that investment as a comprehensive package of not only putting in the affordable housing, but how you preserve not only the businesses that are for those people that are affordable in the neighborhood, but the neighborhood. How do you preserve that affordable housing in the neighborhood, which is, on most of these corridors after the first couple of blocks, single-family dwellings, rentals. And that's a tougher equation, but you start to say, where do they go?
Well, so this will be a really interesting one to the Powell Division to apply this kind of thinking to, because the other side of the coin is one of the reasons we chose Powell Division is it serves a highly transit-dependent population. So there's an equity argument on both sides, and as I said, why it's difficult is, just like Andre said, you got to tease out the costs and benefits, and it would be regretful if we chose not to provide improved transit to a highly transit-dependent population because we couldn't prevent displacement, we can't make that investment without some actions that address affordable housing preservation and production.
Well, and related to that, the East Portland Action Council has asked for some assistance with respect to rental rehabilitation. And having run those programs for Metro King County, the best rental rehab program is one where the owner is not only agreeing to a covenant to keep rents at an affordable level for a certain period of time, but where they're also contributing some of their own resources to the effort so that we can leverage at least 2-to-1 on that effort. So I think for us to be successful, while it's important to hear from the advocates, we need to engage with the owners. And we've been talking with Portland State University about their equity activities in the Powell Division corridor and whether or not building on the work that's already underway with the Bullitt Foundation, if we can't be identifying a universe of partners for rental rehabilitation in that corridor as well, and then do some baseline health impact assessment work to measure the effects of public health on these public investments so that we're reducing childhood obesity, we're improving asthma, we're improving all sorts of important metrics for family health. At the same time, we're also stabilizing the housing supply.
So just, this is very heartening in how we pursue these transit projects. We've always, you know, that we have high quality transit and we've planned it very well. And what we have in this current round is Housing Bureau is engaged, PDC is engaged. So we're looking at it with a community development lens and bringing our community development experts to bear as we're also planning transit. So that's about, that's how it's done in a lot of places. So it's really good to hear.
I also wanted to report to Commissioner Fish, you were looking for the cost burden and of households. With a total of 248,550 total households, the folks that are under 80% of median income that have a cost burden are 45%, which is about 111,505. That's the total universe of households. Renters, you know, we've got renter households under 80% number in about 77,340 that are cost burdened, and owners under 80, it's hard to be an owner under 80% of median income, of 45,740. I'd be happy to provide this. Renter households. Yes.
Kurt, just say.
This is that statistic from 5 years ago, 10 years ago. I mean, how does that compare? I mean, we've dealt with this in the city for a long, long time. Is that out of range?
We'll put it in writing, and that way we'll distribute it broadly, and it can be.
That's one of the sobering statistics we've heard over the last 2 weeks, and the real, if you get past the statistic and you drill down, what we're saying is, people are being forced to make choices between rent and food, rent and clothing, rent and necessities of life, gas, and that's a staggering number that you've just given us.
Well, and you know, I've worked in the D.C. Met.
Kurt, I just had a quick question in the bottom of your one-pager where you said that we've got an estimated unit shortage of 5,380 units and an estimated revenue gap of $538 million. Are we really getting units at $100,000 a pop?
Yes, we are providing public finance at 100,000 units a pop. The total and the total cost of the unit is more than that. We are leveraging $3 for every $1 of public funds. And we have cost containment policies for bedroom size, but that's the average. It's more for 3 and 4 bedrooms, significantly less for studios.
So when you say public resources, does that mean the city's resources?
The city's resources. They all public resources, federal resources that we are a conduit for and deliver to nonprofits, as well as TIF resources, which are city resources that we would be providing to either private developers or nonprofits.
I have a question about the losing the policy of no net loss of land zoned for housing, and what was the discussion about that at the Planning Commission?
The real idea and kind of the discussion was, we've zoned enough land for housing, and that is based on a jobs projection and the amount of housing you need. But if you start taking away land, the concern was, which type of land do you take away?
The current, in quasi-judicial zone changes that the council hears, currently we have a policy that says no net loss of housing. So
I can maybe go into a little more detail there, if you want.
Go ahead. Let Aaron, but I'll come back to what I think our discussion.
Well, the origin of the original no net loss policy was that when we did the comp plan in the 80s, we were short of residential land in our initial run at it. And so it was a state requirement that eventually came on us because we didn't have enough residential land at the time. And the context was, at that time, we had no evidence that mixed use or dense urban residential development was possible. So our buildable land supply was mostly the land at the edges for single family, and we're in a completely different economy right now where we don't have a problem with documenting that we have enough residential land, and in fact the majority of our residential development is occurring on commercial zoning. So in that context, the no net loss of residential zoning it has a high administrative cost, and it doesn't necessarily deliver anything for us in terms of protecting our ability to produce housing. We still have policies in the comp plan that are especially aimed at no net loss of opportunities to produce affordable housing, because that's our issue.
But what about when we get a proposal to change from a residential zoning to a commercial or other zoning, and the neighborhood may be very strongly in favor of keeping at least some elements of housing, but without that policy, we may not be able to require it?
You would continue to have the affordable housing policies to lean on if you're in a situation where the conversion is going to have an effect on affordability.
About affordable.
The other factor is that in most cases, the majority of our commercial development that we're seeing these days does include residential development. So it's not necessarily the case that in most cases the conversion of residential to commercial is actually increasing the housing supply because of the allowed densities. And so the current application of no net loss may be actually reducing housing supply perversely.
There are some things that you can do, though, in commercial zones that you can't do in primarily residential zones, and that's what the neighborhood is sometimes concerned about.
So maybe there's a policy or an approach to get at that, but it's no net loss is about losing housing capacity. That's kind of about compatibility, character, something different.
So how are we going to make sure that when we are asked to do quasi-judicial zone changes, that there's enough consideration of, are we going to change the approval criteria for the zone change?
You know,
we are working on that piece as part of the implementation phase of to implement the zoning code, because we know we have to change that.
What will direct that in the comprehensive plan?
Our current work program with the state that spells out what we're doing to implement the new plan is where that lives.
What are you talking about? What policies are there in the proposed comprehensive plan that will direct you to write zoning code language that looks after neighborhood compatibility when in a zone change?
Commissioner, we can get back to, there's actually a whole bunch.
I wasn't expecting you to tell me this.
Right. And this, though, is an exquisite example of the dilemma we face, because a lot of these neighborhood compatibility debates are going to lead us in directions that we maybe want to go, but that are really going to reduce our overall ability or supply of housing in the long run. And it doesn't say don't do it. It's just that to highlight for everybody, there's a lot of these trade-offs embedded in a lot of the things you're asked to consider. Why we trust the city council.
And the council, though, has to have some oomph in code or comp plan in order to be able to withstand the lobbying we get from all sides, or at least it's very helpful when there's something written down that says thou shalt. In the current comp plan, there's quite a lot about compatibility of new housing. Where is that going to reside in the new comp plan?
It's in a variety of places. Eric probably knows. It's something that we're discussing a lot in the single family infill project right now. The desire for that. And then what's compatibility mean? It's a really good discussion. It's a healthy discussion.
Well, again, when we get to the urban forum briefing, I'd be very interested to know what directs the kinds of housing and, you know, what then directs what the infill code looks like. And then my final question is about the current comp plan has an entire section on vacant and abandoned housing. And I'm not seeing anything like that in this. I see the housing opportunity map, but I don't see a focus on what to do about vacant and abandoned housing. So am I missing it?
We'll get back to you on that. To the earlier question, it's primarily chapters 3 and 4 that address the compatibility and infill design questions and spell out the character issues of different types of places. So that's where we'd be looking. I can get back to you about the, yeah. I can get back to you on the, if there's a vacant or abandoned housing policy, although as we've noted, there's virtually none of that right now.
That's one instance where your policy of 1980s worked. You created PCRI, you funded a lot of neighborhood community development corporations to use that stock, and it's part of the permanently affordable stock.
There's still a lot. Yeah. This one right in my neighborhood.
Still have.
Yes.
Abandoned houses. So there's a zombie period closure and sale. So.
Yeah.
Joe, when are we doing urban form?
Okay. You'll probably get into that. The final session was titled the land use map. And so it's really about all of the decisions and choices we made when we got down to the details of the land use map. And one part of that is obviously sort of what drove the urban forum, and compatibility issues are embedded in that. So it's the November 10th, I believe.
So I just have a request. I think having Housing Bureau, planning, staff, and commissioners at the table together is really helpful for us. So, Kurt, I know you have a lot on your plate, but I hope whenever there's a housing piece, you're here to give us the your perspective as we go through this. Particularly around housing form, because I hope we don't lose track of the value proposition about beautiful, functional, green buildings for our affordable housing as well as our market rate housing.
Well, I'll try my best. The Nexus fee and its impact on commercial property is important from the employment sector, and even though I raise it in the context of the housing section, it's really as much the employment section that needs to be considered.
Well, and just second how helpful this format is, I just want to thank Andre and Maggie and Howard for giving up even more of your volunteer time in addition to your regular work at the Planning and Sustainability Commission to be here to help enliven and inform these discussions, because it's great for us to have you here, but it is a burden on you, and we just want to acknowledge and thank you for all the time you put in. We hope you don't count the hours.
So as a wrap up, thank you all. In a few weeks, we're coming back with the economic development and environment work session. And I just want to do one quick call out. The folks who pulled together the work, the housing section, include Eric and Tom Armstrong, Uma Krishnan and Tyler Bump from planning staff, Barbara Shaw, Matthew Schaubold, and Javier Mena from Housing. Thank you.